At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, I'm Kendra Winchester, here with Autumn Privet, and this is Reading Women, a podcast where we're reclaiming half the bookshelf by discussing books written by or about women. And this is episode 40, where we're talking about the poems of Phyllis Wheatley and Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley's Frankenstein. Welcome back, Autumn.
Hi, Kendra. And you know what? I've been looking at this episode number for weeks now, but when you just said 40, I was like, whoa, 40.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you actually include our interviews, we're over 50.
That's so crazy. I feel like we just started this last week. Oh, time.
Something like that. I remember one of our first posts on Instagram was me editing.
Sad tears for old Instagram. Anyway. That's not why we're here. Let's talk about books.
Yes. So we are going to talk today about, obviously, Frankenstein and Phyllis Wheatley for our theme of classic women. And so we chose these two. So we're really excited to talk about them. There's so much here to talk about.
And I will say that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't really think we're going to have a problem with spoilers in this episode. I know sometimes that's a concern for people when they listen to this episode, but we all generally know the plot of Frankenstein and Phyllis Wheatley's are poems. So it's not like there's not like a big reveal to spoil.
Yeah.
So if you haven't read any of these, like, this is a really safe episode to listen to.
Exactly. Because I'm not sure how you would spoil poems.
I don't really know either. It's not like you're unmasking a villain or something like that at the end. It just doesn't work that way.
No, especially not with Phyllis Wheatley.
So, yeah. So let's just jump into this.
Right. So our first one is Poems on Various Subjects, Religious and Moral by Phyllis Wheatley. And this was published in 1773.
So what were some of your initial impressions of this book?
I had only read one or two of her poems that were mentioned in other texts. So not really a study on her. And what I really loved was this edition by, edited by John C. Shields, because I love learning the literary context of books and like where they sit and what they're in response to. So I really loved how beautiful her language is. And it is the 1700s, so she's a big fan of neoclassicism. So she loves the heroic couplet. Thank you, Alexander Pope there. But also she does, like, as Shields mentioned, she does have some romantic language in there. She has some beautiful language, and I really love the way that she's able to describe her faith and her religion in such a beautiful way, and how you can tell she's giving comfort to someone who's lost someone, because a lot of them are dedicated to people who have lost either a child or a spouse or different things, and the way that she is an encouragement to them.
Yeah, I will say that I did find the couplets a little bit tedious. I downloaded the Kindle version of this, the free Kindle version, and it was only like 80 pages or something like that. So I was like, oh, I can just like read this in a couple hours. Not so. You kind of need to like read one or two and put it away and come back and read one or two more and put it away. More like that.
Yeah. And they're really beautiful right out loud. One of the things that I really love about poetry is that most of them are written to be read out loud. So by doing that, you can feel the rhythm, I think, a bit better, and just the language, and hear the words and feel the words on your tongue. And it's just very beautiful. And that's the same with her. Now, the version I have is actually a reproduction of the original 1773 edition, so it's printed in that original style, so only S's on the end look like S's. All the S's in the middle or in the beginning of words look like these elongated F things.
Yeah.
Now, I thought that was pretty cool. And on one page, they at the very bottom, they print the first word of the next page, so you know what order like it goes in, it confirms, you know, whatever. And just my little publishing heart was so happy.
Ugh. I, on the other hand, was so distracted by the FS's that I had to find a different version. I got really fixated on them. And then, like, I couldn't not see them, and I don't know.
Yeah, they're really, when there's several of them as well, like when they're supposed to be like two S's in a row, and it can get very confusing.
Yes.
They also have the cool T that like swirls back to the previous letter, and they even number the lines of the poems, which is awesome. I mean, that's pretty standard with poetry, but I think it's cool. And yeah, I just loved everything about this, and especially like they use the old punctuation for quotations as well, and I just thought it was so cool. Just let me sit here. And would they make a note in the beginning of this edition? It talks about how they tried to reproduce the almost exact way that's reprinted. So it's the idea that they're providing the public with the exact edition that is in the museum or in a collection, private collection or whatever.
Which actually is cool.
Yes, it's so cool. And it makes a note that they tried, but then they had to reset some of the poems. And this is a collected edition, so some of her poetry that it's not in a collection is in the back, and they had to reset it, so it's in the normal, you know, punctuation and style and different things, so which is also pretty cool to see. Also, you can get a feel for her in the original like printing, but also in the current modern day typesetting. That was for all the other publishing nerds out there. One of the great things about Phyllis Wheatley that I really love is her publishing story.
Yes, she has a really cool publishing story. I mean, it's sad, but cool at the same time.
So, as we said, this was published in 1773, but she is African-American, but this was published in London because in America they were hesitant to publish this. And one of the reasons is because she is, you know, she was an African-American slave woman who wrote this poetry. And as we mentioned in our previous episode, both her master and a bunch of dudes had to sign a thing that was put in the front of her poetry collection that said that they confirmed that she indeed wrote these poems. I mean, I just, my mind boggles, like, how insulting is that?
It is so insulting. It's insulting, but then at the same time, it's...
She did get this confirmation that they put in the front of her collection, but she eventually went over to the UK and she met a bunch of famous people, and she had the Countess of Huntingdon funded the collection. So even though Phyllis Wheatley actually wrote a second collection, she wasn't able to get funding for that, unfortunately. And she eventually did get married to a free African-American man who was a grocer. And then they had two children who unfortunately passed away. And then he was taken to debtor's prison. And then she and her other child died of illness. And she was 31 when she died.
So young.
She wrote most of these poems like around the time she was 20 or so.
Yeah, I think she's either 19 or 20, something like that. Which is actually really incredible if you think about it. And that's one thing that the essay in the back says, is that some people have criticized her poems for a lot of different reasons. And he's like, hey, she was only like 19. I bet you couldn't do any better at 19. And that's so true. I mean, like, they're really elaborate and really stunning poems. I still couldn't write a poem that good, that's for sure.
So anyway, so Shields talks about how he says she is not a great poet, but she is a good poet, and she should be recognized for how good her work actually was. And he feels like her work hasn't been appreciated as much as, at least in his studies, that he thinks it should. And so he lays out a lot of information about her poetry and why he loves her poetry, and which is really cool. So I love how they have the extra essays in this collected works edition. I'm not sure what's in the Penguin Classics edition, but it is really cool to see that kind of literary criticism on her poetry.
Yeah, and I think it's really helpful, especially with someone who wrote so long ago, just to understand the context, the political climate she was writing in, or like the historical context that she was writing in, because I really think it helps like frame what she's trying to do.
Yeah, and she did such beautiful work, and she was a woman of great faith, and she wrote a lot of these poems, as we mentioned, you know, for deaths, or she had a lot of patriotic poetry. I think she wrote one for George Washington.
She did. You know, Kendra, we've been talking about how beautiful her writing is. Do you have a passage that you can read?
Yes. So I have my favorite. Now, I don't think this is her best poem. The editor really loves a poem called On Imagination. But I really love a poem called To a Lady on the Death of Her Husband. And this is an example of one of those, like, in memoriam type poetry. Also, just know that when I'm reading this, all of the S's are as F's, so you're just going to have to bear with me. Okay, so it says, grim monarch, sea deprived of vital breath, a young physician in the dust of death. Dost thou go on incessant to destroy our griefs to double and lay waste our joy? Enough, thou never yet wast known to say, though millions die, the vassals of thy sway. Nor youth, nor science, nor the ties of love, nor aught on earth thy flinty heart can move. The friend, the spouse, from his dire dart to save, in vain we ask the sovereign of the grave. Fair mourner, there see thy loved Leonard laid, and o'er him spread the deep impervious shade. Closed are his eyes, and heavy fetters keep that his senses bound in never waking sleep. So it goes on, but you can see how she is very much honoring the person who has passed away. And I love how she's able to make this death of this woman's husband, who's not even named, seem like this great momentous occasion and a reason to celebrate his life, in addition to obviously mourning his death. And just the way that she's able to create such atmosphere with these couplets. And normally I don't like rhyming couplets as much, but I do love what she's done here. And she has some beautiful imagery, like azure sky and a starry world, and the heavy fetters keep in never waking sleep. And it's just what she did. I just think it's beautiful. I think she has such great imagery, like concrete imagery that we can see in this. And
quite a few of her poems are actually like travel related poems. Like there's one about her voyage from Africa, and there's one about when she visited the campus at Cambridge. Was it Cambridge? I believe.
I'm not sure.
The way that she describes her surroundings in those poems, like, she really brings them to life and they're really vivid.
She just has a way with it. And she has another one called Goliath of Gath, which is one of the longer ones in this. And she actually just retells, the David and Goliath story in, like, this epic fashion. You know, like, the Iliad and the Odyssey are told in poetic form, and she does that the same with, you know, David and Goliath. And I just thought it was just so cool, especially after just reading the Odyssey, reading this version of Goliath's and David and Goliath's story, so which is kind of cool.
So there are a couple themes. It's really difficult to kind of like talk about poetry when it's like all these different poems and we're trying to talk about all of them, but we decided to like pull out some of the themes that she talks about in her poetry. And some of them are like the desire for something that's greater than herself. Like it's very aspirational and like future looking kind of thing.
Very positive.
Yeah, very positive, like very hopeful too, I think. And then, as we've mentioned, her spirituality is another theme. Another one would be like perseverance in the face of horrible circumstances. Freedom. Freedom is a theme that comes up a lot. And then obviously patriotism with all of her poems about, one about George Washington, about the American Revolution, and she talks about King George some too in some of her poems.
She's able to write with such clarity, and you can tell she was a thinker as well. She didn't just write beautiful words. She was thinking about these things, and she was thinking about imagination. And one of the things that one of the essays really geeked out about was her thoughts on imagination and where it came from and what it does to us as human beings, which I hadn't thought about this. What? And so she's like discussing this as like this like 20-year-old writing these poems about it, like putting your thoughts in poetic form. Like, what? I can't even do that now, trying to talk on this podcast. And she's doing it in this beautiful way with these heroic couplets. And
do you want to read a couple of the opening lines
of what, Imagination?
Yeah,
this poem that I'm talking about called On Imagination. It says, thy various works, imperial queen, we see how bright their forms, how decked with pomp by thee, thy wondrous acts in beauteous order stand, and all attest how potent is thy hand. And she just, it goes on for a couple pages, and she talks about just imagination and where it comes from and some of the things that have come from our imagination, and just a lot of figurative imagery. A lot of times we see a lot of concrete imagery in some of her other poems, but this one, she has a lot of different metaphors for making thought concrete, kind of, so you're going like the other direction. And I find that very interesting, seeing a different type of poem from this. And I can see why all of the critics are really love this one.
Yeah, she really does show a range. Because, like, from the one you read before, the more of the in memoriam style poem, and then she has more historical kind of poems. And then this mix of, like, really abstract, kind of fanciful, more creative kind of poems. So her range is incredible, too.
And I haven't gotten to her other poems in, like, all of her poems in the back. But she also has some poems that you can tell she was very opinionated. And it talks about the selection of the poems that went into her first collection, and then some of these other ones that they left out because they were more opinionated. So she has some about theology. So she has a discussion or argument against atheism and an address to the deist. And she's very opinionated, and she lets you know what she thinks. Only they rhyme in couplets. So it's like... It's sort of like you think Alexander Hamilton, only for real and in couplet. And she just, I mean, she's so smart, and she just did a great job. I didn't know what to expect when I picked this poetry as our discussion and as one of our picks for this month. But I'm so glad I did, because she's so vivacious and brilliant. And there's also letters in this collection that I have where she talks about in her prose. And I haven't read those yet, but obviously this dude is a huge fan. That's definitely, I'm going to finish that.
And also, like, the version that Kendra and I both read is, like, the big Oxford University Press edition. But as I mentioned in the last episode, there are free versions of this collection of poems that you can download online or get on your Kindle. So if you want to just kind of see what she's like or read some of her most famous poems, that's a really easy way to kind of familiarize yourself with her work and what she's doing.
Yeah, definitely. And there's so much heritage in Phyllis Wheatley being the first African-American person to publish a work, and just how that tradition started with Phyllis Wheatley and has moved forward from there. And I would be very interested in reading more essays about her works and how they affected the rest of, you know, African-American women writings. And of course, we talked about that anthology in our last episode, so I'm sure there's some discussion in there as well. I just, there's so much here that you could talk about, and it's one of the older pieces of writing that we have as Americans, because it was even before we were actually a country.
Yeah, and that's something that was interesting. Math is not my strong suit, but when she was talking about King George and things like that, I was like, why is she talking about King George? And I was like, oh, that's why, because this is like pre-Revolutionary War kind of stuff.
And we all should know about the Revolutionary War and what order it happened, thanks to Lin-Manuel Miranda. So,
which I haven't listened to yet, because I want to see it live before I listen to the soundtrack.
What? You haven't listened to it yet? I did not know this.
Hashtag purist.
Anyway, so that is it. You done with the Phyllis Wheatley?
I'm done.
Okay, so that was Poems on Various Subjects, Religious and Moral by Phyllis Wheatley. And definitely, guys will definitely want to go check that out. So our sponsor spot is us. We have an Etsy store that is linked on our website and will be in our show notes. And there we have blind dates with a book where you give us your three most recent beloved books, and we will send you a blind date with a book. And we've had a lot of fun doing these.
We really have. And Kendra asked me the other day, when I was packaging up yet another set of orders to send, she's like, how many of these have we sent? And we've sent over 20 now, which is only in like a couple months. So you guys are like really loving it. And so far, all of the feedback that we've gotten is people love the books that we've sent them. And they're a lot of fun to pick out and send. And I handwrite little notes to stick in them and all of that.
And we also have Reading Women award seals and award kits, which include stickers and bookmarks and just a lot of different things. And we also have tote bags. So if you wanted to show off your Reading Women swag at the library or wherever you want to, you can have a tote bag. And I think they're pretty cool. I love the design.
We also recently dropped the price of our hardback blind date books. And a lot of our hardbacks are more recently published books, and there are really some really amazing picks. So if you're interested in getting a hardback or were concerned about the price, we decided to pull it down just a little bit. And then also we have a survey right now, which you can access, I think through our Instagram, and I think it's on our website. I don't know. But if you fill out the survey, you can get a 15% off coupon code to use in the Reading Women store, which applies to everything in there and your entire purchase. So it's not just like on one item. So if you have the time to take a moment to fill out the survey, not only will it help us make the podcast better, but you can also get some books for 15% off. And we will have a link to the survey and to our store in the show notes.
So our next discussion book is your pick, Autumn.
Yes. So I chose to talk about Frankenstein by Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley. And as I mentioned before, part of the reason I wanted to talk about this book is because it is this book's 200th birthday this year. So it was published in 1818.
That's pretty incredible.
It is pretty incredible. And let me see if I can find it. Yeah, so it was published January 1st, 1818.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
So happy birthday to Frankenstein.
So this was your first read through Frankenstein. So what was your initial impression of the book?
Well, I was like 20 pages in and I was like, wait a minute, what am I reading? Because it was this guy who's writing this letter to his sister about this expedition that he's taking to the Arctic. And he's lamenting the fact that he doesn't have a friend to share it all with. And I was like, what is this? Like, I have no understanding of, like, what's going on. And if you only have, like, me up until this point had, like, a cultural idea of what Frankenstein was, like, I was expecting some sort of, like, it was a dark and stormy night and someone rolled up to a castle and lightning was everywhere, right? Which is not what this book is about in any way, shape, or form. There is lightning, but it has nothing to do with the animation of the monster. There are no castles. There are usually, like, huts on the hillside. Yeah. So it was definitely not what I thought it would be.
Yeah, it reminds me of, like, when you read Dracula, and it's like, what?
That's what Josh said. I've not read Dracula either.
I actually fell asleep listening to Dracula, so that might not be the best recommendation.
The interesting thing, though, is, like, Mary Shelley, and I didn't put this together until, like, a year ago. I don't know. Like, sometimes information goes into your brain and then, like, it doesn't stick or something. I don't know. But so she is the daughter of Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote A Vindication of the Rights of Women. And then her dad was William Godwin, who was a political activist and a political writer. So she has very firebrand sort of parents. So a lot of people were like, well, it's inevitable that she's a writer. And she actually started Frankenstein, like Phyllis Wheatley, when she was 19.
And wasn't that the famous story where they're all trapped in a little house and it's raining and they have this competition to see who can write the best ghost story?
Yes, because they were telling, like, Germanic ghost stories. And then she was like, well, I'm going to try that. And then, like, she didn't really. And then she had a dream. And then she woke up from the dream and there came Frankenstein. So, yeah.
And it's interesting because, you know, she's married to Percy Shelley and they're best friends with, like, you know, Lord Byron. And so you have all of these writers, like, in this little confined space, and she is the one that succeeded in writing this amazing story. And I've always found that really interesting, how she beat the boys.
Yes.
And, you know, the first really work of science fiction in the English language, for the most part.
Well, it's interesting, too, because in her introduction, she kind of couches her story in this, like, it was a dream. It's not my fault. I'm not a terrible person. Like, this is why I wrote this story, because we were telling ghost stories. So it's like she situates herself in this tradition of ghost stories, which I think is really fascinating, too. And she also, the book is very referential to her personal life. So there's multiple references to Paradise Lost by Milton, and then also the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And she'd heard a telling of the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, like, before it was even published. And so she wove that into the story, which is crazy that, like, she was so influenced by it before it was even, like, a thing yet. And only in hindsight can we go back and kind of see how important that is. So the Rime of the Ancient Mariner is a poem like Paradise Lost, and it's about a sailor who's returned from a long sea voyage, and he, like, is telling the story when he gets home, which is how Frankenstein starts. It's about this guy, as I said, who's, like, on this Arctic expedition, and he's relaying the story to his sister. So there's, like, a parallel there. And then which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, as you can tell, like, she has so many different allusions in the book to different works of the time. And it means you would have to have met all of these really famous literary people and be very, you know, up to her eyeballs in literature because of, the, you know, the crowd, you know, the people she hang out with and all these different things. And she does, like, there's so much in there. And I find it interesting that you mentioned that she couches all this information because, I mean, she was a woman publishing this really kind of disturbing book in, you know, 1818, which is like, you know, what, at Georgian era or whatever, like Jane Austen,
something like that,
whatever. And so
yeah,
I find that really fascinating that, you know, women have had to like, hey, oh, it's just a dream, like, you know, haha, whatever, like they can't be serious. Mm-hmm. Like literary writers, they always have to like try to disguise it as something else.
Well, and I think too, you see that in the fact that the subtitle for Frankenstein is the modern Prometheus. Prometheus is a mythological character who is credited with creating man from clay, and he's also the one who takes fire from the gods and gives it to humanity. So not only is she like orienting herself with like these folk tales and ghost stories, but she's also like orienting herself with Greek mythology and legends and like situating herself in that tradition as well, which I would assume would be to give her story credibility.
Yeah. And it's really interesting how she does that because Prometheus, he rebelled against the current gods of, you know, and he gave the fire when he wasn't supposed to. He's like, you know, the Titan, whatever. And then he was punished by being tied to a rock and having this eagle come and eat his liver every day. Since he's a god, it regenerates. So it happens over and over. But you can tell like there's a sense that Frankenstein is being punished for what he has created, and he's continuously mm-hmm. punished. It's not just like this one-off thing. And you can tell because he's like writing these letters, telling all this story, and you can tell he's like in classic romantic emotional anguish about all of these things. And you definitely see all that through there. And I just really love that.
Yes. Well, and I knew you'd be able to explain all that better than I could. So thank you, Kendra. But even like on a literal level, like that happens, but like on a even more abstract metaphorical level, when Victor Frankenstein creates the monster, who's never named, which I also don't think I realized that before, the creation of the monster really destroys his family. Like, it sets fire, as it were, to, like, his whole life and existence and tears it apart and burns it to the ground. So, like, at the end, he has nothing. So she even takes it in that way, in a more of, like, a abstract kind of way.
And I like what you said in the past podcast of like the whole, you know, Jurassic Park, like just because we can do it, should we do it? And it really, you know, should, you know, Prometheus give fire to humans just because he can? And you should Frankenstein give life to this creature just because he can? And, you know, science, you know, at the time was, you know, this big thing. And so there's the whole discussion of religion versus science and how she also takes that theme as well in there with the whole, you know, creating life thing.
Well, I feel like with all the, especially film adaptations of Frankenstein, there's a big hoop-de-doo over like the actual animation of the monster. And that part was left completely out of the narrative, which shocked me. There's a lot of description about like how he gathers the parts and the amount of time he spent and the amount of research that he spent and how he like goes to Europe because he's in Switzerland, and how he goes to Europe to like consult with these scientists so that way he can animate this person. And but there's actually like no description of like how it happens, which I was really surprised by. I was expecting like lightning and fireworks and electricity, but
slime,
right?
You know, it really is like this, you know, philosophical in-depth look at life and what makes us human and all of these really deep thoughts. And like you said, like you wouldn't think that from all of the different portrayals of Frankenstein and his monster in, you know, media, whatever. It's not about this thing, violent and empty-headed thing. And, you know, the monster is very, very intelligent.
He is.
Which also is not in media.
No. And like I said in the last episode, he uses like $11 words, you know, like they're huge words. And one thing that really struck me by the time, especially by the time I got to the end. So we have like the story of this kid, and I can't remember his name. That's how important he was to me. This guy who goes out on this Arctic expedition, and then Victor Frankenstein tells his story, and then the monster gets to tell his story. And so you know, after seeing all this from Victor Frankenstein's perspective, the monster's like, how cruel of you to create me knowing that I could never have a companion because I'm so ugly and I'm so hideous. No one could possibly love me. So what's the point of my even existing? Which is such a fascinating question, like, to even ask. You know, it's a very high level question to ask too. And it reminded me, as he's talking about his motivations for why he did the things that he did, it reminded me of the Count of Monte Cristo, you know, Edmond Dantes in that story. And I love the Count of Monte Cristo and how he's motivated by revenge. And I felt like there are a lot of really similar connections to the monster, who's like, the reason I've destroyed all these things that you care about is because you did this really horrible thing to me by giving me life, which is not the conclusion that I was expecting at all.
Is so The Bride for Frankenstein, is there a sequel to Frankenstein, or is that just a movie that came
it's
out?
It's just a movie sequel.
You know, that's sad, because I always felt bad for the monster for not having a wife or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like if God left Adam in the garden without Eve, you know, like, what?
Yeah. It is sad. Like, I found myself empathizing with the monster, which I did not expect at all. And I should also note, too, like, as we kind of wrap this up, is that Mary Shelley wrote a lot of other things. She wrote a lot of travel narratives, and she wrote some short stories, and she wrote another novel too. I guess it technically be a novella. It's short, like Frankenstein, which is also only like 200 pages. So she's very prolific, even though this is like the only book we talk about of hers. But it has just such staying power in society. It's crazy.
I don't know. Just a woman writing in this period and having such length and staying power and not having to write under a pseudonym and just all of these different things. I mean, her mom, I mean, granted, considering who her parents were, I guess it's not totally surprising, but
her mom died like right after she was born.
Yeah,
but still, I mean, she definitely lived up to her legacy, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So that is Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, and it's definitely an interesting read for sure. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend reading it, even just for the context. And she's a good writer too. I enjoyed it a lot, actually.
And there's probably a lot more you could read about it in, like, critical essays and different things. It's old enough. It probably has, like, tomes and tomes and tomes of stuff written about it. So,
yes.
And I think that's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that is it for now for this episode. Remember that we are now on Spotify, if that is your podcatcher of choice. And again, if your podcatcher of choice does not have Reading Women, please send us a note and we will see what we can do about that. And please review us if you haven't already, especially in Apple Podcasts. And you can also check out our newsletter for new books, reviews, and so much more. And all of that will be linked in the show notes.
So thank you all so much for listening to this episode of Reading Women. Next month, we will be talking about poetry.
Ooh.
I know. And it will not all be poetry and heroic couplets. So
yeah, we even have a poetry novel on the list for next month. So I'm pretty excited about that.
I know, all kinds of exciting things. So don't miss out on that episode. So that will be in our April episodes. And you can find Reading Women on all the social media channels at The Reading Women. And you can find Kendra at KD Winchester on Instagram and Litzy and Facebook and Twitter. And you can find me at Autumn Privet at the same places. And thank you all so much for listening. And we will talk to you soon.
Bye, guys.